today is going to be good. It's episode 14, and Forrest Mickey is with us. If you're not already familiar with Forrest, he's probably one of the most thoughtful trainers around today. At least that's my opinion. In this episode, he shares with us some of the new concepts and techniques that he's been playing with and getting excited about. He also shares some tips and techniques for teaching your dog to do a down at a distance from you, which is quite challenging if you've never tried it before, as well as his strategies for working with dogs who whine and vocalize during training, usually from overexcitement. This is a great conversation. You're going to want to stick around for the whole thing, so let's get to it. Just like our relationships with other humans in our lives, our relationships with our dogs are dynamic and complex. I believe that in order for those relationships to flourish, or to find resolution when those relationships become strained, we must attend to them thoughtfully and with care. Welcome to the Consider the Dog podcast, created from archived recordings of live sessions where our members get to ask their most burning questions to some of the greatest practitioners of canine behavior. I'm your host, Tyler Muto. I hope you enjoy this episode. And remember, if you want to join the conversation live, you can visit us at considerthedog.com.
Welcome, everybody. Forrest is watching the birds over there while we're trying to connect. Forrest, thanks so much for joining us, man. It's been a long time. We caught up the other day for the first time in a while. And I'm certainly glad to have you back here.
Glad to be here.
Let me mute my computer. I'm talking back to myself here. Okay, cool. So quick intro for those of you guys that are not super familiar with Forrest, and this is not like Forrest's official bio. You can certainly go on our website and get his official bio, but I've known Forrest for a long time now. And I actually remember, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Forrest. I remember the first time I ever saw you, and it was in the background of a Michael Ellis video, like one of the first Michael Ellis videos that came out on Learburg. And I remember I was watching it in bed on my laptop and my wife was there. And I actually remember like looking at her, I'm going like, this guy right here, I think his name's Forrest. This is going to be somebody that we got to keep an eye on. Like, this is going to be somebody to keep an eye on. I could just tell the way you were moving with the dogs, the way you were handling with the dogs. Like, it just, you were kind of in the, you know, you were in the background of the video, but it just sort of stood out to me. And I'm not sure if you were I think you were just a student of his back then. I don't think you were an instructor for him in those early days, because this was one of the really beginning Michael Ellis videos. But I remember that. And then I remember not at all being surprised when you started building out your own courses for Learburg. It was not at all a surprise for me. So for those of you that are not familiar with Forrest, and Forrest, you can correct anything here, because I certainly, like I said, this isn't your official bio, but you know, Forrest, I think, really made a name for himself, you know, in the sport world. And particularly what has always stood out for me is sort of the gracefulness that you have when you're working with dogs. And especially, I think, where you really kind of garnered a lot of attention earlier in the days was in the realm of heel work and focused healing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was always something I always thought was like majestic in my early days of training, watching focused healing. But kind of now when I watch a lot of focused healing, even the stuff that really blew my mind in the early days, a lot of the dogs look really kind of stiff and like very anxious. And, you know, there's an intensity there that maybe some people like, but when I would watch you with your dogs, it was the attention was there, the motivation was there, but it was like, it was a partnership. Like it was just really, really pretty to watch. Forrest specializes in a lot of motivational training, a lot of relationship-based training, a lot of work with engagement and play, and certainly brings a tremendous amount to the table. So for those of you that are new to Forrest Mickey, I would certainly encourage you to poke around a little bit, search his name on YouTube. You have your own website, correct? ForrestMickey.com. Is that correct? Yep. So check out ForrestMickey.com. You actually have some streaming video there that's available as well that people can check out. And we're certainly happy to have Forrest here and to answer some questions. So we're going to jump right into things. So, all right.
Thanks for that. I would say,
did I miss anything?
No, that was good. Most people do say exactly what you said. They said, the first time I ever saw you, you're getting yelled at by Mike Ellis on the, what is it, Advanced Concepts in Motivation DVD or something that they watched. So I was actually living, I was living in Wisconsin at that time, but I got a couple of, I got one Malinois, my guy Elzer, who's still around. And at that time, Michael, you could get him to come in and do a seminar and there would be like six or eight people there, right? So he was coming to Wisconsin every few months to help us with our dogs. And there'd be six or eight of us training. And then he and I developed a friendship. And then after about a year, he invited me out to California to teach at his school. So, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I don't even remember what video it was. I don't remember Michael yelling at you.
It's in there somewhere.
I'm a little disappointed. I got to go back and scroll through. But I do just remember watching you handle dogs and, I could kind of just see, you know, sometimes you could just tell, right, when somebody sort of got it, right? Cool. So we've got a bunch of questions that rolled in on the Facebook group in advance, and then we've got some stuff rolling on the stream. I'm going to start with a couple of these Facebook questions. So we got a question here from Mikey, and he's curious to hear your advice on getting started with obedience from a distance, and then specifically like a down from a distance. And look, that there are a lot of different ways that people approach this. I mean, some people do back ties, some people do raised platforms. Do you have like a current sort of favorite path you'd like to follow to get there?
I think what I see most people doing now that seems to be successful is as early as possible, they're using, like you said, a table or a platform, but targets, so physical aids. And, you know, you can hands off shape it, or you can, you know, however you get the dog to identify that they go to that thing and that that's where they're paid. You start from a close distance, and then you would eventually, as the dog's getting it and they're sort of magnetized towards that thing, you can create distance over time. But the idea is that very early on with a dog, you kind of present this concept that even though I have reinforcement with me, the best strategy by which to get it is to move away from me and go to that thing. And what we are finding, so in ring sport, it's a common problem when there's an exercise where the dog has to perform position changes from a distance. And a lot of dogs that are just like too drawn to the person. And it's because in the early stages of training, a lot of the food comes for me or the toys come for me. So the dog's really drawn into me. They expect it, especially for dogs that are just really motivated. They get sticky. So they're really stuck on the person. And so when you put them at any sort of distance and you start asking them to change positions, even if your mechanics are built correctly, like it's common that people teach a fold back down and the dog to come back up into a sit. They creep forward, so that's hard for them to keep their piece of real estate because they so badly want to be closer to you because that's where the reward comes from. And so I see this most commonly in IPO training. And I think that, you know, just certain training styles or like structures within sessions sometimes are more common in one sport versus the other, but they do a lot of sending dogs away to platforms or tables or foot target. It's all the same thing, right? It's a physical aid that's meant to draw the dog away from you. And then the big thing though, I think at that point, so if you can have a dog that, you know, can easily and with, you know, without feeling like, you know, they're losing something by moving away from you. So they run with conviction towards say a physical target that's away from you. If that's going well and you're adding distance and it's still going well, I think you have to start thinking about how they expect to be rewarded then when they complete that task. And so if you're sending dogs to a target and you're saying yes, and they're coming back and still getting reward from you, some dogs that can go really well, like my wife has border collies, and I feel like they just come programmed with like, you ask them to do the thing and wherever they are, they do it. They're less like compelled by or preoccupied by the rewards, and they're more almost task driven just genetically. It's kind of interesting. In the Malinois, it's harder for them to let go of the reward. So it has this constant pull at them. So even though I'm sending them to a distance target, and they get there, and if I were to say yes and commonly reward them back to me, I think you're going to be in trouble at the point where you try to reduce that target, or you try to say, hey, that's no longer there. And I just want you to hold, you know, a spot out in that field and do the thing. And without that help, like the magnetization of the reward or just being close to me starts to creep in and deteriorate what you might've thought was good work. So at the point where you have a dog moving away from you and going and occupying a target, that's fine. That's one step. But to consider then how the dog expects to be rewarded in that situation is probably the next bridge you have to cross. And I'll just speak a little bit to how I handled it with my dog Elzer. And then I'll tell you how people are doing it now that I'm interested in, and I've got a young puppy that I'm working with. So Elzer was a, he's a Malinois. He's cool, likes toys, likes food. I did some really beautiful work, I think, on him, you know, in his life. And there was a point where we were competing at a low level in Mondio Ring. We never went to great levels with it, but he did really well at the low levels and the competing that we did do. But I did notice that in the position change work, he was, you know, just really drawn to me just because of all of, you know, the reinforcement that came here. And so in the positions, he would lose a little bit. And the common practice for like helping that or mitigating that was to, I think Tyler had said it, like put a line on the dog and teach them that they have to back off of it. Or you could use an electronic collar to, you know, like subtly move them back, teach them to move off of the input. And so that can sort of like temper them a bit. But I started to teach him that the position change exercise culminated or ended, and you could say like a terminal response to that exercise was he went backwards. And what I had in my head was his mechanics were good, right? But I was trying to polarize his energy between two things. Me, this really sort of like valuable thing to him, and where this exercise actually finished, which was going backwards. And in the beginning, I was planting toys behind him. And ultimately, I had like the strong possibility that after I ask you to change five or seven positions, I'm going to say behind and you're going to run backwards and put your feet on a foot target. And so in that setup, in the context of position changes, it really leveled him out because he knew that he took instruction from me to complete tasks. But this exercise, this setup always ended in going backwards. And that really, like for him, he's an eager dog, and he was external, right? You could just see the energy like vibing off of this dude. And it actually settled him in a little bit too, because there wasn't so much power from me and the toy and his desire to get it. He was split, right? Between this and that, which was behind me. And maybe the more interesting thing that I observed, just aside from getting more solid position changes, is him not creeping, him being like holding his piece of real estate, was a sort of contentment almost. Like, I'm more content being here doing this and less urgent about coming to you because I care so much about the reward from you. And I like how it settled him in mentally in that exercise. And what I do with, and I've raised a lot of like dogs of different breeds since then. And so just a common thing that I'll often do in position change work is release them backwards behind them for food chase or toys if they're a toy dog. And you can play fun little, I'll just give you a little quick setup. You could do like, if your dog has like verbal signals for position changes, like they're running to you and you can say down, and they down pretty well. Then you can always like get them in this back and forth rhythm, even as a young dog, as long as they've got like some ability to do this, to perform the behavior, is they're coming back to you and you say down and they do it. And you can say, get it or chase or whatever the heck, and throw something beyond them, behind them. And so that they learn when they do that, they're probably going to go backwards. And a lot of times it gets dogs to like stop in their tracks, go down faster, and also neutralizes, if you want to say, their energy. And that's just playing with the energetics of it. Right. A good indication of like if the dog is going to start like creeping forward or not do the thing so well that you're asking is how they look when they're on a distance target. So if you have been practicing the dog performing position changes on a table, for example, and you're adding distance. And if while you add distance, if you see like their claws coming over the end of the table or something like that, or they're just barely hanging on.
Like they look like they're perching on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, dude, they're like, it's a good chance. I would say like, dude, once you take that thing away, that dog is just going to be creeping forward. And so I realize I'm kind of talking about like this gets particular because maybe I'm talking more to the idea of the dog already does position changes from a difference, but we're distance, but we're picking on like if they can stay in one spot or if they want to creep and come forward. And maybe it's a little bit of the same thing. The way that it's happening now that I see good, like the good sport training that I like, particularly for ring sport, which again, the dog has to hold their piece of real, they're penalized if they move forward or back, is people are drawing strong awareness to the front paws. And so the dog can stand, can sit and down, which are the three changes that are asked for in most dog sports. And the dog just knows to keep their front paws like where they're at as they go through and cycle through all of these position changes. And that's tough. I think it takes a bit of skill to draw the dog's attention to that and make them aware of exactly what those paws are doing. But, you know, it's happening. The thing that I'm going through with my young dog right now, which is kind of interesting, is a lot of people, if they're looking to draw attention to the front feet on a target, draw attention to the front feet or awareness, like the dog knows if they lift the paws, like, oops, I shouldn't have done that. So I keep them down. And even when you ask me to down, I can pop all the way back, but these never move. As they'll, you know, they'll start by using a touchpad or a 2x4 and just getting a young dog to run and put their feet on there before they ever ask a position change. It's are you committed to this? And can you keep your paws in place? And then you can proof simply that, right? Like, I'm going to bring food to you while your paws are there. You lift a paw, oop, you're like, you're unsettled, right? So you need to stay there and be content being there. Cause if you are, like, this is going to come to you. And a lot of times you get dogs that will calm down in that. And then once they're really aware of their paws being on something, a physical aid, then you can start to manipulate them however you choose to do it, you know, into the various position changes that they're going to go through and cycle through. And so that's like, it's not too difficult to get a dog to kind of understand like putting their feet on something there. What I'm playing with right now, and I have a friend who's a very high level Mondio ring competitor, and she does this with she never loses points in positions, right? So I ran across her. She lives far away from me, but we happened to cross paths recently, and I asked her about this, and it kind of bothered me a little bit when she told me about it, because I could see all of this like the possibility for confusion on behalf of the dog. But she starts by putting a young puppy directly in contact with a food lure. And she just, well, she works as the down to a stand and a down to a stand. And very early on, without having any of this prerequisite, like you're aware these paws can go on a physical target, she starts right on the ground and is luring very slowly. The dog is in contact with the food the whole time, but is luring them into a down and then back into a stand. And is very early on picking on a dog, a young puppy, right? And she's a clever, gifted, experienced trainer, so this goes well for her. But me, who I reckoned I was a clever, experienced, gifted trainer, went through it with my dog and I was like, this is crazy stuff. But the dog is really interested in the food, right? And so they're almost the right kind of dog that's sufficiently driven for it. They almost can't be aware of what their body's doing because they're completely preoccupied with this, right? And so you're saying like the dog comes up, you're luring them slowly into a stand and they lift a paw and you're saying, nope, you're wrong. And or you pull it away, oops, right? And to expect that dog that was just trying to get, you know, the piece of food out of your hand, and that especially the ones that are really eager for it, like they have no idea what's going on with their paws. That was my thinking. Like, I could see this going totally wrong. I don't understand it. But there's something in there about the dog being like in pursuit of the food. And at the same time, while they're doing that early on, you're telling them also to like consider what's happening all around them. And it could be a little bit ugly in the first few sessions, but there is something in there when you play with it that like they start to go, I'm pursuing, but I also have to think a little bit more about what's happening in my body. And there's a little magic in there somewhere. And I found it myself. So, but I was interested in that spot, like the dog, a young dog being in pursuit of their thing, but also the ability to like, to say, you can pay attention a little bit while you're doing that. And so I can let you know how that goes.
Nice. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I had a dog that he's actually my sister's dog now. It was a little pit bull that I had found on the street many years ago. And he was a wonderful little dog, is a wonderful little dog, very food motivated. He was maybe 10 months to a year when I found him. And I took him to a seminar with Francis Metcalf.
Cool.
With his circus school.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of food based off and luring the dogs into like sit pretties and spins and all this kind of stuff. And he was one of those dogs that it's just like, he was so bonkers about food that when that food lure was right in front of him, he really just like had no awareness of what he had. Yeah. No idea what his body, you could lure him into anything. He would do it, but he didn't know what he was doing. And it is interesting because you have this, like, that presents a challenge, but then it also presents an opportunity.
That's right.
And that's something that we think about a lot when people ask, like, oh, you know, my dog does obedience really good, you know, sort of until they're through the roof excited or aroused. And, you know, yes, that's a challenge. But when we train with food, or people say, you know, why would you want to train your dog with high levels of motivation or get them all cranked up for a toy? You know, when what you actually want is for them to be able to control themselves around distractions. It's like, yeah, but isn't that sort of part of it, right? Like if we don't allow the dog to practice being sort of consciously aware of what we're asking of them or what they're supposed to be doing while they're in those states of mind, that how can we, you could do all the e-collar training and leash corrections and all that you want to. But unless you're able to regularly emulate, here you are in this elevated state and I still need you to focus, you know? And so it's just kind of reminds you of that. It's like a little bit of an extension of that same idea.
Yeah.
Of that same idea. Yeah.
That was I'll just really quickly, I'll say this. Tyler, you mentioned earlier on about like focused healing work and how you were seeing some dogs that maybe just looked a little bit pent up. One of the things I really like about some of the work that's happening now is I'll drop a person that I just really admire for her obedience training. And it's Mia Skogster, and she's a Scandinavian trainer. She's over in Finland and she makes beautiful training. But I would see people luring dogs directly into the hand to like develop some muscle memory, like a head up or whatever, and maybe even to capture some sort of expression. But the dogs that are directly, same thing we're talking about, driving into the hand with the food, they might look a certain way while they're directly in contact with the target. But the minute you move it off, it becomes different because they never were able to like develop maybe an awareness of what their body was doing under the hand, because they were just so preoccupied with getting the damn piece of food out of it. And so I find that for a lot of, and they don't look comfortable. They don't look natural. They look pent up because they're just putting so much into this thing. And so what I like for, you know, myself and especially well-driven dogs is that they learn to follow a target, but they're not directly in contact with it. And it lets their body like loosen up a bit. They're still very committed to a precise point, and you're still creating so much of the healing experience or whatever that you want from it. But you're giving them a chance to feel the movement and be a little bit more aware of what's happening, because, you know, they're not so directly into this thing. That's kind of like blind
tunnel vision. Yeah. Tunnel vision as well. Yeah, exactly. So a question come in here from Westchester dog trainer on the stream. It sort of ties into this because, you know, you sort of mentioned what you're seeing now that you're really liking. So this person asks, you know, are there any new techniques or strategies that you've really started implementing this past year or two? You know, what's worked well for you recently that you feel guilty not sharing, they say. you know, what are you playing with? I mean, what are you up to these days? I mean, I know I'm always changing what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I'm a tinkerer for sure. And, I've got a young dog that I like quite a bit. I waited a long time to get my next, like dog that I'm going to spend life with and hopefully be able to do the other things that I endeavor to do, like some sport work. This is interesting. Francis Metcalf, I bumped into him the other day. You mentioned him earlier, and I always love seeing him. And he said something to me that really stuck. He said that because people were asking him if he's going to raise another young dog. And he said, it's hard to raise a working dog in a place that there's like so much other training going on, because they just get a little frustrated, right? You can't like put them in a crate and they're sitting there watching like the world go by, right? Like the way that he wants to do it is he wants to, you know, give them a full day and the right experiences. And so if they're cooped up a lot, there's a lot that can happen, especially for like these eager working dogs. And that just stuck with me because I know I waited a long time till my early sport dogs were at a certain age where I felt they were just settled into life. And before I felt like I had the time that I could give to the way that I want to do it to another young working prospect. And so I got one now. I mentioned her name, Mia Skogster. And I bought for my wife, I just wanted my wife to watch this magical person train, right? And so she's got a resource out there she's a hell of a trainer. It's dog training, right? It's all dog training, but she is very focused on doing something it's the sport of IGP. It's a very it's an artistic like sport when the people are doing it at the highest level. It's kind of beautiful. It's this balance of drives and precision and whatever. But I bought my wife her resource because I wanted her to see watch Mia Skogster do this training. And so we were watching her healing stuff together. And I was like, I was drawn into it. My wife at some point was like, I've seen enough. And then I sat and studied all of her healing work. And she's got a number of videos where she raises this dog from 8 weeks to 6 months. And I have gone down, I have gone after healing work, like as much as anybody's ever gone after healing work. And maybe like for better or worse, it was just something that I was really drawn to. And I was just interested in how people were making it. What's cool about focused healing, and I don't know, there sounds like there's some sport people on here. And maybe if you're not, and you have no idea what we're talking about, I'm sorry. But it's also a place where like a lot of concepts in dog training can be illustrated well. Like we talked earlier about reward placement for dogs that, you know, you want them, if you ask them to down at 50 feet, that they do it right in place because they know that they're listening to you, but you might pitch the toy, right? So that polarizing thing. So that's a reward placement concept. Like, where does it come from? And what does that mean to me? And how does it affect the way that I'm showing up in the behavior before the reward? Because it can impact it. And so healing is interesting in that sense. And it's beautiful in a dance and all that. But I watched her do this, you know, train her young dog to do healing work. And it was so right and simple, but still technical, but not overdone. And it kind of was convicting to me because I just felt like I overcomplicated this process, right? Like I wanted to break it down to the finest details, and I could make beautiful healing, but sometimes it was at the cost of like the dog's attitude. You know, if you tax them too much with little things, they might go like, well, this is more of, you know, like I need to really pay attention to this. This isn't about drive or my energy. I need to slow down and catch all these details. And so you can sort of like tone a dog down a little bit. And there might be an advantage with certain dogs. You might choose to do that because they need it, or you might do something like what Mia was doing, which I think was this confluence of like the dog had the right feelings for it. The dog was learning all the technical skills it needed to. Everything was efficient. Like she wasn't creating anything like that was going to be hard to get rid of later. And it felt right by the dog, and she's training a Malinois. And so that to me, I looked at how easy the work was coming together, at least for this puppy that she was training. And she's a hell of a trainer. So the other ones that she does. And when Polly came in, I just followed her work. And for the first 2 weeks, basically I laid her foundation with him, and then I didn't touch it for a long time. And it was the easiest, best healing work I laid into a young Malinois in a long time. And now I'm adding pieces that I like, but I was kind of convicted, like, man, it doesn't have to be like the way that I thought it should be, right? And that was somebody that I was really happy to see and learn that lesson from. I'll say this though, I'm very happy that my journey with all the information I've grabbed, whether for healing or for other things, is there, because there are certain dogs, like it's the temperament and it's the breed and it's the energy that they come with, their drive for things, that will you know, dictate an approach that you will take. And so though I would never train a young Malinois, a young expressive Malinois or sporting dog with any other healing foundation than what I observed from her. But like a border collie, a dog that like, if this is a little bit of a tangent, but what is happening is some people are manufacturing some sort of expression in healing these days. And they're using like certain targets or certain methods to teach a dog that would normally, like a border collie, like when they're working and they're intense, they're kind of stocky and they're like, they're super focused, they're super correct, but their tail doesn't wag much and they look like they're kind of pent up. Right. And so if you were to do maybe like Mia's style of healing with that border collie, it might be a little bit stockier versus if you spend a long time teaching it to drive and express up into either a baited target or an unbaited target, like a hand target, which is kind of common these days. You can take a dog like a border collie that would otherwise show up with a certain expression, and you can kind of play against that and say, this is how you're going to learn to express because I've spent all this time manufacturing it a bit. And so that's interesting to think about, because you can sort of say, I'll do it this way, or there's another approach that would actually help this dog, you know, show up a different way than they otherwise would. So I guess maybe I'm, to answer that question, I'm saying you could look at Mia Skogstra's healing work and not mine.
Yeah. That's, but basically, I mean, you know, just to sort of, I guess, summarize, like, that's what you're doing right now. You're sort of reevaluating heel work and you're playing, you know, sort of back in your dog training stomping grounds in a sense, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. Which is, I think it's so wonderful, because it's like, I'm always a huge proponent of just like continuing to go back and master fundamental skills, yeah. and things that you can say like, oh, I've kind of got that. It's like anything super fancy and flashy and advanced is really just always based on the same fundamental principles,
yep.
Just applied really, really well.
Yep.
You know, yep. And I think that's great.
Hey, listeners, just a quick reminder. These podcasts are created from archived recordings of live sessions where members of our community can ask questions and interact with our instructors in real time. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's 3 months for $10 a month, and you have access to not only these live sessions, but also our library of hundreds of exclusive videos and courses on dog behavior. Again, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST. Let's get back to the show.
You know, we've mentioned a few times now about dogs that sometimes maybe, you know, they're like over aroused, and how do we create in the training like a little bit more of calmness. And Danielle is on here, and just really quickly, Danielle Stuber is Danielle is one of our moderators on the Consider the Dog Facebook group. So for those of you guys that are maybe a little bit new, you know, you'll see Danielle's name pop up a lot. And Danielle used to work for me. And the whole reason that I got connected with Danielle was through Forrest. I did a seminar at Learburg in Wisconsin, and Danielle was a student of Forrest, and he encouraged her to come. She had a Malinois that was a bit reactive, and we connected there. And she asked me about doing like an internship over the summer. She was in school at the time. And normally I don't do those kinds of things, but Forrest gave her such high praise that I said, what the hell? And man, you didn't steer me wrong, because I had Danielle at my place for a couple months, and I was trying to convince her to drop out of school. And she didn't, but she did end up graduating early and then moved back to Buffalo. And we at least got her for a few years before she moved back home and branched out on her own. But she's just a phenomenally talented young lady. And we're certainly really glad to have her part of Consider the Dog and helping us out in the Facebook group. But so her first question is, when are you going to come do another seminar in Illinois? You know, we can get to that. But the real question here is, and this is something that I think a lot of people deal with. I know we deal with this here at the training center with German Shepherds, particularly. How do we deal with leaking and vocalizing and whining, you know, particularly while working obedience? But I think this could bleed into even some of these dogs that it's just in certain areas of life, they just are squeaky. You know, they just get in. And like I said, we see these dogs come in. I always know when there's a German Shepherd in my lobby.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's this very distinctive sound that we go, oh, there's a GSD here.
Yeah.
So how do we deal with that? How do we balance the drive and the energy with the quiet, thoughtful, precise behavior? Is there anything specifically that we can be thinking about to help with that?
Yeah. Well, they are German shepherds, so there's a genetic predisposition.
There's that. Yeah, that, absolutely.
That frustrate easily. I've got one that I'm working right now. It's actually a friend that lives close by, and she's training for the sport of IGP. And so she comes twice a week, and we're just creating these really clear setups, these really clear paths towards the dog's incentive. And I find out that like the clear, if the dog is motivated towards a specific thing, and maybe I'll say I'm going to speak from within a sport context versus an everyday life one, but perhaps there's parallels. This guy is exactly that. He's really great in the protection work. I think he just loves to be frustrated and he loves to bark. And he's got a long line of dogs behind him that equal that. And there's a couple of strategies that we use. One, in general, if the path towards his reward or whatever his motivation is, if the path there is clear, and in our training setups, we're not asking him to endure like more than he should on a certain day. And I know that's kind of like a gray area. What's the should? He keeps it together very well. He understands that, like, so for example, if I throw a toy out on the ground and I want him just to be quiet and stare at the toy, and it's a new concept, the moment he looks at it and he's quiet, he gets to get it. And if I wanted to add on that, if I throw a toy on the ground and he's got some healing understanding and I ask him to foos and he looks at me right when he connects the dot, I send him to it. And the next rep, if I throw the toy on the ground and he asks me to look at, I ask him to look at me and he looks at me, maybe it's 2 seconds and he gets to go. And I'm not adding on too much too quickly, less some of that frustration can bleed in. And so I think just in your training setups in general, you would want to just, if it seems like it's becoming a problem and the dog can't quite keep it together, I would first ask a person, like for me, I'm looking to observe their training and just making sure everything feels clear and that the dog's not being like confused at some point or asked to work beyond what they're, what they know, what they understand. And that's a big thing for me when I go around and see, I see a lot of clubs that are still traditional in their IPO work, and a lot of them like German Shepherd dogs. And there's just not a lot of clean training that's going on. But if you see it, the dogs usually keep it together because the path towards the reward is really well understood. And the other thing, like a strategy that I really like for dogs that just they get pumped up and they vocalize because they're unsettled or they just can't bear it, right? They can't bear the uncertainty of it, or they're just like they're thinking so much about the end goal that it's causing them to feel that way, is we divide their expectations. And so this has become way more popular in the last 15 years, especially in protection sports, but there's two outcomes here. You could, if I say so, run down and get that reward down there or bite that guy, or if I say otherwise, you might take the reward from here, right? So like some of those dogs get fixated on the end result, and it's the only thing that's going to happen, and they freaking know it. And so they're so like there already in their minds, and all this stuff I have to deal with to get there is getting in the way. And so a strategy is that we develop two possibilities, two things that could happen. I could send you to your toy down there, or I could say you're going to play with me with a toy right here. And what you do is you sort of like, you split the mind. Maybe Tyler, I might've heard you say this one time, but like, it's easier to work. Like if a dog was exhibited aggressive tendencies or reactive tendencies in certain contexts, it would be easier to, and let's say it's little white dogs that it has trouble with, it'd be easier to work that dog around five little white dogs than one little white dog because they can't fixate on it. Right.
Yeah. I call it the lion tamer effect.
Okay, cool.
Because, and I don't know if this is true or not, but the reason I call it that, I heard at one point, this might be one of those things like, you know, just these like urban legends, but I heard that the reason that like the old school lion tamers in the circus would use like a stool or a chair You know what I mean? They have like
So there's
their
four
whip
points
and a
on
stool. There's 4 points.
it.
And the lion goes, where do I bite? Because all 4 points are sort of equal close to it, right? Because a lot of dogs, like, you know, when I deal with aggressive dogs, I always say, like, a huge safety thing is put something between you and the dog. Most dogs are going to bite what's closest to them. If you're holding a broom and that broom is angled out towards the dog, they're probably going to strike the broom before they strike you, unless it's a dog that's trained to go around obstacles like that. But if, you know, if you have three brooms and they're all equal distant, the dog might go, huh? And actually, our mutual friend Brent Dry, he wrote like a, I think a, like a blog post about that same thing too. I think he called it like something like spliced attention or divided attention or
Oh,
something.
cool.
But also really quick, I just want to interject because this reminds me so much of what you said in the beginning of our chat when we were talking about the position changes. And you mentioned that with your dog, when you gave him the option that sometimes you're going to get rewarded behind you, that you found that that settled him. That the idea of, you know, that little bit of uncertainty, that little bit of, well, I don't necessarily know which way I'm going to go, so maybe I should just hang here and wait for more information.
Exactly it.
And that sort of that created that bit of a settling. So I mean, is what you're talking about right now kind of the same idea?
Exactly it. Yeah. It's not a given outcome. There's multiple possibilities. And what you said is kind of the crucial thing is they have to wait around to get the information that they still want to know what direction they're going to go with their energy. And that works as far as like those things are pretty close to each other. Right. So like where it comes into a problem, if you can raise a young dog and you can sort of like establish equity and different values, like you can go play with that person over there with a toy, but it's just as well to play with me with a toy. Or you can go bite that guy wearing a sleeve down there. This is talking about protection sport, not I want them to go bite the guy down there, right? Or you can play with me with a small ball and a string down here. And it seems like you're really into this as much as you'd be into that. That's when that stuff works really well. If there's some sort of inequity there, then you've just got work to do within like those experiences. So I had when Endy was like 8 months old, she was really into the bite work and she was having a hard time playing with the person, 7 months old, the person that owned her at the time. And so she shelved bite work for a couple of months and just played with her within that context and got that back. Got a dog that when you'd ask her to out from a toy while a decoy's there, she stayed looking. Out expectations still with you, right? Not surfing around or looking around because that might be an indication she'd rather be there. So she got, you know, she earned, she captured her imagination within the context of play, even though that thing appeared to be a possibility. And that's when you know you can probably easily do something like have multiple outcomes for a dog, deny them going down and doing that thing down there, and instead have them play with you here and that they're not going to feel punished by it. There's certain dogs that if you said you're going to play with me right now, even though you'd rather do that, that it's a tough, like it's hard
Disappointing.
for you to accept that. But I would say this, there is a discipline within that too. So at a certain point, like if you want to have multiple outcomes, which I think is really important, like there are, like in this setup, there are a number of ways this could end. It doesn't have to be 10, right? I don't need to send you to a food dish with kibble in it or a food dish with raw in it and have different words that mark that, right? That permit that. But having some sort of alternative play event or reward event for them that competes with that, that's probably the big thing that we're saying here. And then, you know, like what people are doing, like what goes on is we have different reward markers. So you just have different words that let them know you're either getting that or you're getting this. And so just like we're saying a lot of times that the dog has to stick around for more information. You've on the front end, as you've raised that dog, you've made sure that your play game is as good or whatever you're going to give them in one place is as good as the other place. And then you can raise the stakes that can become better, but this still upholds its value and the dog is equitable in a sense. Or they become disciplined and go, I'd really rather have that because that's the kind of dog I am, but you're always been fair and good to me. And I will take this because I also know that I kind of have to, but it's not like a big sacrifice. It's cool, right? And that gives you options in training too. And so it comes like this thing we called breaking logical pairs. This I got from an AKC trainer years and years ago. But imagine a dog is sitting in heel position and you've got a dumbbell in your hand. And they know a retrieve, they know it well, and they love to do it. And you pitch the dumbbell out there. The dog's like, the next logical thing is I'm going to go and put my mouth on that damn. I'm going to run out there, grab it, and I'm going to bring it back to you. And they're not wrong because that's the way the retrieve really goes. But you do have like the ability to if your training is good, to say, I pitched the dumbbell, and instead of you running out and grabbing it, I'm going to heal you away and reward you from that. So you steal some power from that exercise. And it's, you break the logical pair. For the dog, they were sure they were going to do it. You've proofed their healing by asking them to do it, even though they were sure that was going to happen. So you get a chance to reward them coming back in to heal, which is kind of cool. But you also keep them honest a bit, because, or attentive to you, because it's not a given that that's going to happen. And so that's a proofing in itself. And often dogs that you play that stuff with, you go, hey man, I'm going to break this logical pair. I'm going to violate this expectation, not in a bad way, but in a fair way, that those dogs settle in and you become more relevant, because not as much is given. They can't work ahead so much because you're a little bit mm-hmm. tricky and you're orchestrating this experience yeah. that they're required to check in and go, is this what we're doing or not? And I feel it can keep dogs honest, and it can keep you centered, like you more salient as you're putting like exercises or programs together.
And that's such a balancing act, because so much of the way they learn is based on anticipation. Mm. So it's like, we want you to anticipate that, you know, after I say couché, that means was couché the down or the stand? I don't even know the language, but the down, right? After I say couché, the next thing is you're going to be reinforced if you go into a down. So I want you to anticipate, but not too much. Yeah. Find the happy medium there. Yeah. Are there any, you know, I'm curious, are there any beyond, like, for instance, ensuring that your play has been, you know, sort of developed enough, right? Or the way you work with food has been developed enough. Are there any other specific strategies or drills that can help dogs get more comfortable with, what do you want to call it, like switching drives, like from sort of like bite work mode into like, I'll take a, because I know some dogs that, like, if they think they're playing ball, even they won't take a food reward, or if they think there's food present, they won't take a ball. And I know there could be a lot of value there. We've talked a lot in our group here at Consider the Dog about different strategies for helping dogs learn to sort of de-escalate arousal. And a couple months ago, we had Sarah Bruski on here for a stream, and she talked about how she really likes to sort of, she creates a hierarchy of reinforcers as far as how much arousal they create. And then she really likes to be able to work with dogs on being able to go down the hierarchy, right? So at first, it might just be like this value food, shift down to this value food and still be cool with it. But eventually go, if the dog's crazy about tug, be able to go from tug to like, sure, I'll take kibble, you know? And I know I've had dogs that don't do that very well, but I think it can be obviously valuable from what you're talking about, from a practical and very pragmatic, you know, training approach for teaching certain skills. But also I think just, again, I'm of the belief that the more we help dogs develop, for instance, the skills of not getting overly frustrated or how to de-escalate from arousal, that if we do that enough and we spend enough time on that it can really help to bleed into other areas of life, especially if you're raising a working dog. Cause I see this all the time in my line of work. I see young trainers that get their first Malinois and they spend all of their energy with that dog. All of the conscious effort that they put into interacting with that dog is all about, I want you to be as intense as you can be. I want you to be as motivated as you can be. And sure, the dog does have calm time, like around the house. But during that calm time, we're not congratulating the dog in any way. Yeah. Like, we're not telling the dog how much we like them. We might be petting them and we're calm too, but we're not deliberately saying, hey, what I need from you right now is for you to be calm. Mm. And so I work a lot with people on exercises that they can do to at least, not saying that you don't have to do any of the motivational stuff, but if the spotlight is always here, at least take some of that spotlight and occasionally shine it over here. Yeah. And I you know, like Sarah Bruski mentioned that she does that by some of this, like having the dog be able to switch modes, which you were just kind of talking about. So I'm curious if there's, you know, any other skills that could be helpful for developing that.
Yeah.
Or techniques helpful for developing that skill, I should say.
Let's say with the whiny German Shepherd, for example, and so maybe Danielle had asked this question. I know, like, a lot of times our reward events, the dog breaks out of position and gets this dynamic reward event. And I do see a lot of people with dogs. And when I was rehabbing a lot of healing work, dogs that were vocal, I would just reward them in place a lot. So it was like undermining the expectation of the reward event. So like, don't think about breaking out and don't be too pumped up about it. It's not as cool as you think it's going to be. And yeah. So I would like lessen the value of it. And yeah. They would, like what people are afraid about when they do that is like, is their drive going to, you know, diminish at all? Or is it going to change the way they show up in position? But you know, food has a calming effect on dogs, or a lot of them, it can have a calming effect, especially if you make them mindful about it. So, it's a good strategy. Don't break dogs out of position so much. Don't mm-hmm. break those shepherds out of position so much. Reward them in place. And that might help.
And that's actually, you know, like at my training center, that's actually almost exclusively our reward markers are stay in position.
Yeah.
Till the reward comes to you. So it's a marker, but it is a little bit operant, because if the dog breaks position, it's like the reward's on its way. But if you break position, that truck turns around.
Yeah.
You know, and we do that very, very deliberately, because again, people are not coming to me because they want their dog to be crazier.
Right.
They're coming to me because they want their dog to settle down.
Yep.
And, you know, very early on when I got into motivational training, I recognized that, hey, even though like Michael Ellis and these guys that are doing sport work, yeah. like they're saying, release the dog out to reward it. Like maybe that's not in my client's best interest, because yep. they have a different set of goals.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not good to do. It's like, you got to understand what your goals are for that dog. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some dogs you yes more than you good. Some dogs you good more than you yes, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I was in Europe. First time I went there for like sport training was maybe 10 years ago or something. And there was something that stuck with me a lot. I saw, and I was going out there to watch protection sports, but these guys would go out, guys and gals would go out and work their dog in an exercise. And then they would put their dog in a down and just feed them food, you know, kind of without making a big deal about it. So food. And then when they were decided what they were going to do next, hey, I'm going to move on and I'm going to do this next exercise. They would walk back to their dog, or if they were close, they would kind of like formalize themselves a little bit, call their dogs to a sit, and then they would get into heel or say, let's go. And they'd move on to the next exercise. Then they would do their little bit of training, reward their dog, however they're doing it, if they did it all. And then they would put their dog in a down again. And then they would let it breathe. All right. Like, cause the ring training is kind of like a long program and a long game. So there's no rush, right? It's actually not productive if the dog's burning a bunch of energy or if they're in too aroused of a state, if you want to say. And then, so the dog's in a down and, hey, here's a piece of food, Fido. Good for you. No, here's a piece of food. On to the next thing. Right. And they would kind of mm-hmm. come maybe to a little bit of attention. So they would change actually, you know, their demeanor, call the dog to a sit. The dog gets closer to the entry back into work. Let's go. And this, like a number of clubs that I saw between Belgium, France, Switzerland, a lot of them did this, right? And they were all ring clubs. So I could see the strategy here. But then I went and watched a Belgian ring championship, actually just happened to be going on when I was there. And I saw these 4, 5, 6-year-old dogs on the field in between exercises. Some of these guys did it. Some just, you know, could move on with it. If the judge was talking, if there was any sort of pause, they'd put their dogs in a down, and you would see these dogs just go down and shift. Right? They would just be like, I've rehearsed this so much. Whenever I go into a down, it's like it's an idol. It's Mike Ellis calls it soft attention. They're still in the game, right? But they're not putting any energy into that because it's been rehearsed that this is a place where I hang out. It could go on for this long. If anything, I get some food chucked at me and that's cool. I can take it. And they just teach them that from a very young age. And it becomes about how they manage the whole session. And so they go from like these more dynamic things, like you're going to go down for a send away and grab your toy and come back and play out, hey, down. And the dog just learned that there's this ebb and flow to their experience of training that's going to have these high and lows. And without being so particular about, you know, can the dog, you know, eat the salmon, you know, kibble, and then can it accept the turkey kibble, the beef kibble, or whatever. Like I know how people work those things. It was, it was less tedious in a sense. It was like, this is the way your experience out here is going to be structured from a very young age. Maybe when like reinforcers are closer in value naturally, because like if a young dog that's going to like toy eventually more than food, for example, you've got a spot where they might be pretty close to each other. They're already saying like, hey, a little bit of toy stuff here. Hey, a down's going to happen. I'm going to pay you some food for that. We're not rushing anything. Well, if you don't take the food, I'm still going to hang out with you calmly in a down. Oh, eventually you might take the food because you're letting go of that thing that you wanted to be doing. You're further removed right now from chasing the toy around. So that helps. Time can be important in that. But with the end result is a dog that that's just the way they move through training. And so you don't get a lot of this. I'm not going to accept those things. I did have a problem with Elzer at a point in his, when we started leaning into the bite work more, where I wanted him actually to, it was more just interested. Can you take food right now? Even though you think you're going to do another face attack on that guy. And he was, non-appetitive. he didn't want to eat no dang food when that decoy was out there. Right. He was so worked up. It was, he couldn't even imagine doing it. It wasn't in him. Can't eat right now. This thing is going on. And so I just took a couple of weeks and, just captured that back. And all it did was, like I would still send him down, do your face attack. Hey, good boy, go bite that guy. I know it's your favorite thing in the world. Boo, whistle back for the ball and the small ball on the string. He'd come back well because I'd done my job there. And then put him in a down. And then, you know, he's obedient. So he goes into a down. I try to give him some food. He's just like too worked up. I said, cool, no problem. I'm not going to rush to anything now. And I let some time pass. And I don't know, maybe like, I remember the first time I did it, I was on a training field in Vallejo, California, where I lived. And I think after a minute, he accepted some food. So that time led him to clear his head a little bit. I might've had my friend actually sit down, like go away and sit down. And then he took it. And then I went and did an obedience exercise, 'cause I was blending those two worlds, protection and obedience. So that was part of my program. And then we circled back to a face attack and did the thing. He whistled back, boom, asked for the down. And then he was quicker to accept food. And that went really easy because I had a lot of things in place, but I have seen dogs resist that because they can't get out of the cycle in their head. And I think that just how you structure your training matters. At that
make it part of the program.
Yeah. You have to make room
make
for that
part of the program. Yeah. And I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit like, you know, so like you put Elzer in the down and then you kind of had to wait. And then by the time you give him the reward, the food, like it's somewhat disconnected from the act of him getting into a down, you know? And so I know like one thing that comes up a lot in the pet dog world, in the behavior world, is like this idea of, we get clients all the time. We meet dog owners who just, you know, treats just for looking cute, treats, you know, for basically no reason. And I think there's a really important distinction that needs to be made between giving a reward for no reason and giving a reward for doing nothing. And it's something that I pay a lot of attention to, especially with reactive dogs. So for instance, if I'm just hanging out in a room with a dog and somebody else walks in or another dog walks in and this dog does nothing, I want to reward that.
Yeah.
I didn't reward for no reason. I rewarded because sometimes doing nothing is a really good option. And I want your system to kind of stay aware of that. And I say system because, like, we know, like, so much of conditioning is biological, right? Like, it's, you know, I always say when Pavlov did his experiments, ringing the bell and feeding the dogs, those dogs weren't choosing to salivate. It was just their bodies becoming conditioned. And this dawned on me actually a little bit after working with Bart Bellin. And, you know, he's a Belgian ring guy. And he was so big on, like, in exercises, like his recall, he would click not when the dog got to him, but when he felt the dog was at its peak of, like, speed and intensity in that recall.
Yeah.
And he'd worry about the finish later, but he wanted to build that. What you're being rewarded for right now is intensity. And so after kind of seeing that, and I sort of workshopped it in my mind, and I was like, yeah, but what if what we're after is the opposite? And why can't we selectively reinforce low arousal and get the system conditioned to, in certain contexts, the expectation is low arousal? And that's what I was thinking about when you were talking about those guys in Europe. And then when you mentioned with Elzer, it's like, yeah, they're putting the dog in the down, they're giving food, but it's, we want the system to know that sometimes the path to sustenance is to, like, stop trying.
Yeah.
Like, right. Stop doing.
Yep.
And with, especially with so many reactive dogs and overly aroused dogs, they're always trying to achieve.
Yep.
And with, like, the young sport dog trainers that I work with, a lot of times that's what they've created with their dog. It's like the only way for the dog to ever get anything good is they have to push for it.
Yep.
And then they run into all these problems. We go, well, what if we just create some exercises
Yep.
somewhere in the routine where the key to the reward is to stop pushing.
Yep. Yep.
The key is to stop doing. The key is to actually be non-reactive to the environment and to do nothing.
Yep.
And then even more so, target those lower arousal states and see if we can get the biology to remember that, and the body to go, wait a minute. Okay. I'm in the down. I think, I mean, like, obviously it's not conscious, but like if the body were conscious, right, the body's going, I think if we just like bring the adrenaline down a notch, maybe we can get some food to happen here. You know what I mean? It's interesting.
It made an impression on me, my time. And I'd gone a number of times since over in Europe, but I think they really had it together. Like they really knew how to get these high energy dogs in a sport that like, they're going to be out there doing the thing they love most, fighting people, but creating this overall experience right from the get go that there are, it's going to be this, like this up and down experience for the dogs. Mm-hmm. And they took their time, there was no rush on anything. Like if it was such a contrast from what I was experiencing here in the States at the time, because like another example, guys would be on the outskirts. It wasn't their time yet. They're on the outskirts of the field. Their dog's not up doing the training and they're sitting there with their young dog, on the end of a leash with a flat collar, and the dog's just chilling, right? Like waiting its turn. If the dog like acted up or something, hey, knock it off, be quiet. The dog, okay, fine. And then the dog would go out there and they would do their work. And it was kind of, it wasn't as detailed and precise as things that were happening in the States, and their obedience, like the stuff we were doing over here was better, at the time, but the dog had the right attitude the whole way through. And I'd come back here and the dog would, sit in their crate or come out, do a little walk, potty and stuff before their session, come out, dynamic work. There's 10 other dogs behind and we only got one person that's kind of running this, this seminar or whatever. So we've got to move kind of quickly. No time to like sit and chat and breathe. No time for those downstays, right? That's not the priority out here. The priority is like, I need to let this dog bite again and I need to work him with the stick and I need to get him to crush through this accessory and blah, blah, blah. No time for obedience. This is a bite work seminar, right? And so these dogs got they were really set up for failure in a sense, because the time the guy comes out there and goes, well, I want to do some obedience after I do this. And the dog has never had that in their experience. They're like, no way, dude. All I do when you put the harness on and I come out here and that guy's in the suit is I go and bite him versus I can listen to you. I'm expecting there's going to be a down that's going to happen here. And so then we had a lot more work to do later on when we wanted to actually give the dog the idea that we could mix those two worlds. They were getting it over with right from the beginning, and that was the better thing to do.
So. Yeah. And it's so interesting because I remember when I first started getting into protection sports, like way back in the day when I used to dabble in it, and especially out here in Buffalo, like the sort of more modern approach to things hadn't really reached here yet. And everything was still that mindset of like from like, 8 weeks to, 8 months or a year, make the dog as like insane, like don't even do obedience, like just ramp up the dog's drives, ramp up their bite work. And then we'll do and then you have to like crush the dog's obedience into them because they're just so out of control. And then, again, we started to see more stuff, around the time that like Michael's work became popularized, not to say that he's the only person that was doing this, but, because there's guys like Ivan and Dave Croyer and stuff out there too. And where it's like, no, like we can do obedience, but especially if we're doing it like motivationally, it's not going to interfere with the drive development. And what you're talking about almost seems like sort of like the next phase of that. It's like, yeah, but like now let's make sure like when we're actually at our club or at the trial that even though we've started obedience, let's use it in sort of a conscious way to create some peaks and valleys in our dog's sort of experience of these events. It just seems almost like the progression of that, I guess.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool, man. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Thank you so much. And it's been really nice to have you here. I hope we can have you here again soon. I know we actually had a bunch of questions we didn't even get to. We'd love to have you back on and chat more and maybe get some more videos from you on our website. I know everybody's asking on here about like, what you're going to be up to career wise and you're sort of like me. You like to kind of periodically go into the shadows for a bit. I mean, is there anything on the on the horizon for you with your next moves in your career?
I guess real quick, it's been good for me to, I live in a place that I like, and I feel drawn to the surrounding community. And so, just kind of seeing how I can, without giving too much of myself, be of help in some way to folks around, because that feels good to support, dog training where you live. And, I've got a young dog that I'm raising. So if I'm ever inspired by something, or I feel like I'm working on something that I think, you know, isn't just more noise, but maybe could make a good point and be helpful, I like to capture that and put it together as a resource. So I've got something in mind that I'm working on, just obedience wise, maybe sport specific. So thinking about that, but, man, just,
enjoying life.
Yeah. Give me a couple of questions. If there are two good ones that are on there, I'm not going to answer them, but I'm just going to, I just want to think about them a little bit, and maybe it could influence some sort of like thing that I do for Consider to the Dog.
Okay. So, like Dylan's asking about luring versus free shaping when working with puppies, specifically for sport protection, advantages, disadvantages, preferences, if any, why, and that could of course be situationally specific. You might prefer one or the other for specific exercises. Let's see what else we got on here that might be good. Another one, this might be a little bit sort of, you know, out of your normal scope, but it's, I guess, sort of relates more to like pet dog stuff. But Karina's asking, she's got a Doberman German Shepherd mix who's pretty reactive to people entering the house. So how do you handle those kinds of things? And I think that's, I mean, obviously if you're living with Malinois, that's got to come up, right? Like you're living with high drive dogs. Like how do we own dogs that are bred to be drivey and territorial and protective? And I mean, you know, maybe the answer is, you know, hey, I kennel them until people get settled. And I think that's what sounds like she's doing right now. Sure, leave him in his kennel until he's calmed down.
We've got a dog like that. Yeah.
You know, but, if there's any other things that you like to work into your routine, I think that's another cool question.
Okay, cool. I'll think about that. I would say this, if I could, we're opening up a couple of training weekends, here at our place in Oregon this summer. So I'm going to post something on the Instagram or whatever. And I don't know who's on here and where they're from, but it's not going to be sport specific or dog specific. So you could always reach out to us if you're interested in hanging out in Oregon for 3 days and just doing some dog training with us. But that's one thing that I'm aiming to do, is just open up my space to invite people in and spend time with them without too much of an agenda, but just, you know, do dog training and share life a little bit. So that's just something.
Nice. Yeah. Cool, man. I like it. Like a little retreat.
Yeah. Yeah. Do some yoga in the backyard, pitch some tents. Yeah. You know?
All right. Cool, man.
Thanks, Tyler. Thanks for putting this together so quickly. And for anybody that's on here, you know, we're able to get on kind of last minute. It was a pleasure. Yeah. And
yeah, anybody
watching this after the fact, hi.
Indeed. Yeah. Thanks everybody for the questions. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, third Thursday of the month at 3:00. And in the meantime, you know, feel free to continue the discussion in the Facebook group, and hopefully we'll have Forrest back here again to keep answering some questions for us.
Yeah, I think August. So, cool.
Yeah, thanks everybody.
That's going to do it for today. Be sure to check in next time when Sarah Dixon will be back joining us and answering behavior questions from our members. We'll see you then.